You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 55 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht.
And I'm Jessica Van Dam.
And today I'm savouring a fruity chamomile tea, which is really nice. It smells like a meadow. It smells like a summer meadow, which is just really lovely. And how about you, Jess? What are you drinking?
I was out running errands, and so I have a green tea lemonade.
Iced
green tea lemonade. Yeah, it tastes like summer to me because that's what I drink all summer if I'm out and about running errands and have to get something to drink. So
There you go. So we both have summery drinks today.
I'm intrigued by the fruity chamomile.
It was one of those ones. I don't even remember where I got this one. I think I got it as a present or something. And it just smelled, you know, when you like lie in a freshly made pile of hay? I don't know if that's like a thing that people do.
I live in the country. So yes, I am familiar with that.
You know, that smell. And it like, but one with like lots of wildflowers in it and stuff. It just smells really like... Yeah, I don't know. It's very nice. It's very refreshing, but also very soothing.
Pastoral.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Rural.
Very rural.
Rural.
And those of you listening might be like, huh? What's with this new intro? Why did they say, I'm Matilda Siebrecht and I'm Jessica Van Damme? And that is because Jess is going to be joining me on Tea Break Archaeology as my co-host. Woohoo!
Yay!
Which I'm very excited about. We've been chatting about it for a while because those of you who've been listening to the podcast for a while will recognize Jess from a couple of different episodes now, on this one and on Am My Trowel, which I co-host with Ash Airy. So yes, after a while we decided, you know what, let's just collaborate fully and you can come on full time. It's nice. It's also just nice to have someone to chat to.
Exactly. I was gonna say, it's, you know, it's nice that you don't have to talk into the void.
Exactly.
You can now talk to me.
Yay. So we have, I mean, obviously you've been on fairly recently as well, actually, as a guest talking about knitting. So hopefully, if people have listened to that episode, they'll know a little bit about who you are already, but maybe we can sort of discuss it in terms of the podcast, because I guess I should also introduce myself a little bit again to people, because it's been a while now since my last kind of little introductory episode. So I am an archaeologist, and my specialism is more kind of prehistory, so pre-written word, northern cultures, which sounds very vague, but it's varied a lot in my sort of cultural specialism. So I've done like Viking, Scandinavia, I've done North American Arctic, Canadian Arctic, I've done Northern Scotland, I've done Northern Netherlands, I've done all sorts of northern cultures. And then I specialize in material culture. So that's also why this podcast is so focused on things and objects and crafts and stuff like that. Because and then we thought it would be really interesting because Jess is, well, you could tell them a bit about your approach, I guess, to old materials.
So now I am an art conservator. I work on objects primarily, so anything three-dimensional. Usually when people hear art conservators, they're like, oh, you work on paintings. And while that is the most lucrative, and I probably should have done that, I didn't find it as interesting. Paintings are beautiful. I love to paint, but they are much of a muchness, in my opinion. So anyway, so that's what I do now. Well, theoretically, I don't actually work for an institution at the moment. I work for myself.
Yeah.
But then my background and how we met is I have a master's in archaeology. I focused on human osteology. And then I also have a bachelor's in forensic anthropology. So more dead people. But yeah, so I think it's interesting that we both came from archaeology, but ended up in objects, but from different directions.
Exactly. So that's what we thought we could kind of explore a bit more through this podcast, because also your kind of cultural focuses have been a little bit more varied than mine in terms of kind of parts of the world that you've looked at and studied and learned about.
Yeah. I think I've wandered. So like when I was younger, and actually still true, but Egyptology has been a huge interest. And then more recently, I've looked into South Korea's cultural heritage. Well, Korea's cultural heritage, but with only
there's only one half
South
will allow us to do stuff.
Exactly,
with
yeah.
Yes.
I think my Dutch passport does allow me to get into North Korea, but that sounds terrifying. So,
I mean, would you be able to get out? I guess is the question, right?
Like, yeah, I don't think they'd like that. But yeah, but anyway, so
yeah,
different cultures and interests, and working for the PBD Essex Museum early in my career, I had a lot of access to, I mean, a lot of different cultures. So like Maori and a lot of the like oceanic islands.
That's
like Fiji.
Cool. Yeah, that would be super. Yeah. I remember that when, so Jess and I both studied at Leiden University. That's how we met each other. And they have a very big department there, which looks at Caribbean archaeology. And I always just used to look at the
objects.
Oh, yeah,
we did that maritime archaeology class together.
Yes,
right?
we did that together. I remember that.
It was so good. That was such a good class.
The problem with archaeology is there's so many really fascinating different spheres. Like, I really wanted, because I did scuba diving, for those who don't know. And my aim with that was to go into maritime archaeology. But then, yeah, I've kind of veered off into another direction with that. But you've
it's
done.
It's late.
Well, I guess maybe not. Oh, there's so many things to do, though, Jess.
I know. It's never enough time.
But am I right in thinking you worked on some kind of boat? Or was that like a little decorative boat?
Oh, I've worked on, so I think you're thinking about the ship models.
That's right.
So
yeah.
They have not touched water, to my knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah. But I do know a weird number of like ship-based like maritime knots, which are very fun.
Oh, that is very cool.
Okay. Yeah, love a good knot.
Yeah.
And I did help out on a ship's figurehead, so she had
that
touch
was
water.
It. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That.
She was cool. Yeah. Louisa is what she was named.
Louisa.
Theoretically, it was based off like who the artist made the model out of, but we called her Louisa.
That's very cool. It's every time I see. Do you know The Repair Shop, the TV show?
Yes. Yes.
And I've been watching like the most recent seasons, and every time I see, I think it's Lucia, who's the art conservator. And that's, I know you were saying you're not a painter, you're not the painting one, but like every time I see any of them doing any kind of repairs or fixing of things, I always think, oh, that would be really cool. And especially though with the painting one, because you just see it, the cleaning process is just so satisfying to watch. It's really like,
it's really satisfying.
Yes.
Yeah. So that is the one exception to painting conservation, is that it is really just lovely to watch them take off that like top layer of varnish.
Yeah, that stained
and just, like,
varnish. Yeah. Oh, it just looks good.
Yeah. that's yummy. There's been a few objects that I've had that have that similar, like, yes, that scratches my brain kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
But yeah, they indeed, every time I see that, I'm always like, I should have got into conservation. And whenever I chat with you, actually, so this is going to be terrible, actually, for me, having this new collaboration on the podcast, because after every recording, I'm going to be like, oh, man, I should have got into archaeological conservation. That would have been so fascinating.
Again, it's not too late, Matilda.
I know.
If you get me into some sort of archaeological company, dig, whatever, I will teach you.
Sounds good.
We'll have a grand time.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. But so, yeah, so we're going to, this podcast is still going to focus on archaeological objects, on ancient crafts, on all of that kind of stuff. But we're going to have another perspective on it in the form of Jess and her experience. So looking forward to that. But for this particular episode, we thought we'd sort of get to know each other a little bit again in terms of podcasts as podcast hosts by talking about our favorite crafts and our favorite objects. So maybe we can start with our favorite craft. And seeing as I just had you on about knitting for two episodes, I feel like I can maybe know what yours is, but maybe you'll surprise me.
I mean, yeah, no, it's knitting. I mean, there's no contest. I mean, I like other handcrafts, sewing, embroidery, but knitting is what I always turn to.
That's
pretty easy. What is your favorite craft?
Well, see, it's difficult because, so actually today, Jess is based in the US, I'm based in Western Europe. So I'm ahead of time. It's my evening at the moment. And I've just spent the whole day blacksmithing, which has been a lot of fun because I volunteer for a local museum here in my town. And we have a historical blacksmith. And at some point they were talking about like, oh, we really need someone else who can come and do blacksmithing. And I was like, well, I'll do it. Like, I'm happy to try that out. And it is so much fun because, yeah, I mean, you're playing with fire and hammering things, and it's just, yeah, it's really satisfying. It doesn't really matter if you're not very good because you can make something kind of cool, even if it's just a bit of twisty metal. So yeah, so that is really fun. However, you know, we were talking about it in the one where you came on, that I've recently gotten into crocheting. And I really like crochet just because you can just take it everywhere with you, which is quite nice. Whereas you can't do that with blacksmithing.
Yeah, so in the same vein, so I work for Harrisville Designs, which is a local to me yarn, fiber, and weaving center.
Cool.
And mill. They're very cool. They make looms, they make the fiber, like they spin the yarn. It's all very cool. And so when I came on, they were like, oh, do you weave? And I was like, no. And they were like, you don't weave yet. And I was like, okay, got it. And so one of my coworkers was like, oh, well, you could just weave while you're here, like while you're working. And I was like, wait, that's allowed? Okay, great. So they sent me with a little project and the like loom was already warped. And so then I was like just sitting and weaving and I was like, oh, this is really lovely. That, oh, I really like this. And I was like, oh, wait, it's stationary. Like I have to be in this spot.
Yeah.
Unless I like buy a loom and somehow fit it into my house, which like ain't gonna happen. But it's nice to have those like go and do them crafts and then also the like mobile crafts that you can do on the train or, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
It's nice to have both.
Because I used to do a lot of like, well, I still do. I really enjoy like sewing and leather working and that kind of thing. But that's also similar in that you technically you can take it with you, but it's just a bit more like you have to take, for example, with sewing, you have to take like all the pre-cut, you know, the bits that you want to sew together. You have to take them all with you and everything. Whereas with the crocheting, what's nice is I can just do like a little project and just have like a little ball of wool and my needle and just kind of make something. And maybe it'll turn up being as big as the bit of material that I would have sewn, but I don't know, it just feels a bit more portable to me.
Yeah, I mean, even if I'm knitting a whole sweater, I'm like, oh, I'll take that with me, that's fine. Who cares? But like, you know,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, it's like it's too many pieces, too many moving bits in sewing, whereas
and you constantly have to check that it's good and check that it, whereas I mean, I know that technically you have to do that with crocheting and with knitting and stuff as well, but I feel like it's a bit more visible, like it's you're building it up rather than piecing it together.
So yes, I agree,
a bit easier to do. And so, like I used to really like woodworking, and I know you do woodworking as well, don't you, a little bit?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I've come from a line of carpenters. So
I was about to say, didn't your dad do it? Yeah. So it's sort of...
my grandfather was a professional one. So.
Ah, cool. Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
But like, it's sort of, again, that, you know, you can technically take like a bit of wood and like whittle it. My husband does that sometimes. But it, again, you have to take it with you.
I have one of the little carved tooth.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So part of my dissertation was looking at teeth as a age of death estimation technique. And so Matilda's husband very kindly crafted me a carved wooden tooth and it sits on my bookshelf.
I'd completely forgotten that he made you that.
What? I didn't. It's amazing. It's so good.
Well, because wasn't it because you were talking about it with him at some point, how basically the very like oversimplified elevator pitch for your thesis was teeth grow with kind of with tree rings almost?
Well, like, yes. Yeah.
So, and then he was like, ah, this is giving me an inspiration.
I know what to do with trees.
Well, and I mean, so knitting and even crochet, we already kind of talked about in the last episode that you came on, but, and we talked about like the history of it and how it grew and all that kind of stuff. But do you feel like since you, because you were knitting since before you studied like archaeology and anthropology, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was six.
Yeah. So then would you say that you're, kind of the things that you learned or like your experience that you had with archaeology changed your perspective on the craft, like on knitting?
I think our podcast episode did. I don't know if it really made the connection while studying archaeology that like about the history of knitting. Like it's never really thought about it. But now I've been thinking about it and thinking, oh, do I need a PhD in that? That sounds fun.
You and your gathering of degrees.
It's so fun. Give me an activity. No, but I think more like generally and not just like knitting, but in conservation specifically, I've looked a lot more at how things are created in relation to how I can fix them. And so that has been, I think, really important. Whereas like archaeology, I mean, unless you get into the material culture, which you have, but I didn't in uni. So then the how they made these things doesn't necessarily come up. It's just like they had them.
Yeah. Them. Okay. That's fair enough.
Yeah. So I think conservation made me more aware.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think for me, it was also, I guess, once it's more the other way around, actually, it's not even necessarily indeed the craft. I was looking at the craft differently, but look, in my various crafts that I was doing, as soon as you learn something, as soon as you see that, like in a museum, you know, you see a piece or something, and then you just kind of understand how it would have, you know, like the amount of effort and skill and everything that would have gone into it. You know, I think if you don't understand how something's made, it's very easy to sort of look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's cool. But I mean, well, that's the whole thing with all these small businesses, right? Showing, you know, it costs that much because it takes me hours, you know, like it's all this thing of people not realizing the skill involved in all of this stuff.
Yeah, this came up recently, actually, because somebody came in. I wasn't at work at the time, but somebody came in and had something that they needed repaired. And so they were talking about that. And then they were like, oh, and, you know, would anybody knit a sweater for me? And so one of my coworkers was like, well, if you have $1,000. And my immediate reaction to anybody saying like, oh, can you knit me a sweater? I'm like, cool, $5,000, easy. Like, we're not talking less than that. You will pay me a living wage. And people, like even $1,000, people are like, I'm sorry, what? And I was like, but I can teach you to knit. And then you will have a greater respect and appreciation for how much time goes into knitting a sweater. Because it's like at least 100 hours, typically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of time. The fastest I've knit a sweater was 9 days. So I'm very proud of that. But it was, you know, big gauge. It was big needles. But like, people have no idea of like what it takes to create something. And like with blacksmithing, I'm sure this comes up too.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Well, and even today as well, I went when you were talking about weaving, they also at the museum have a like 200-year-old loom that they occasionally have. Oh, cool. There's this lovely volunteer who's amazing at it. And so she comes and like demonstrates it. And so I went there today with my daughters and we were watching it. And, you know, she was like, it's also one of those things. And I was trying to explain to my daughters, you know, like, look, like this is how you make the cloth. You know, here is the bit of grass that is linen, you know, that you basically then have to do that. And it's really good. They had all of the like the stations to see all of the different processes that are involved. There's this really cool one, actually. I must try and find it and put it in the show notes. There's a woman on Instagram who's growing her own dress. So she's like...
Oh, I was just about to mention her. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, the linen. Oh my God.
Yeah.
She's fantastic.
And it's incredible. But like, yeah, she's obviously, it's taking ages because she has to grow the plant. She has to prepare the plant. She has to like thrash it or whatever it's called. She has to spin it. She has to do this. She has to do that. Then you have to weave it and then you have to sew it. Like there's so many steps involved. And I think it's something, you know, there's all, even with slow fashion, it's still very difficult to really perceive, like, okay, if you actually want to think about what goes into making a good quality garment, like the amount of not just material, but the time and the skill and the different types of skills involved as well.
Right. And then like linen specifically, I mean, it's such a like a tough plant that it like just the processing of it takes weeks where you have to like basically let it rot outside.
Then
hit it with things and then do all these things. Whereas like wool, it's like you clean it, you like part it, and then you spin it. And so like you can cut, like it's a shorter process.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a spinnery in Vermont called the Junction Fiber Mill, and they do really cool videos about like their processing.
Ooh.
Like process.
Yeah.
Processing process.
Are they really called spinneries?
I don't know that actually.
I mean, that's adorable.
It's probably... I hope so. If not, I just made it up.
Yeah, there you go.
And we can TM that. But maybe I should call it a mill. I think a mill is probably more reasonable. But
okay. Yeah, that's probably what they use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Harrisville Designs is also a mill that spins.
Yeah,
yeah. So a spinnery mill? I don't know.
Spinnery. I prefer spinnery. I think we're going to call it spinnery from now on.
Okay, we're just going to claim it. TM.
We're going to put all of these links, by the way, into the show notes for people who are curious and want to check out all of these accounts.
Yeah.
I think that sounds good. I think we should have a quick break to top up our tea, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Hope your teacups is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So in the break, by the way, Jess and I were just chatting about how we were going to Skillshare. So she's going to teach me conservation and I'm going to teach her blacksmithing.
I'm so excited. This is going to be great.
Looking forward to it. It's going to be wonderful. So watch out for that in various things. So
we can do the knitting needle.
Yes, the knitting needle experiments. I still really want to do that. Like, I really do.
Anytime. I'm ready.
Okay. Maybe I could make some metal knitting needles, actually, at the blacksmith.
Oh, that'd be sick.
Just to try them out, you know?
That'd be so cool. Oh my God. I'd be the coolest knitter ever.
Viking style. It does not. Viking style knitting, it does want to be metal because the Vikings very much used, like, anyway. So we talked about craft before the break. And now, of course, so not only does this podcast focus on sort of crafts, both traditional, historic, prehistoric and modern, but also talks, of course, about archaeology and archaeological objects. So I have to ask, Jess, what is your favorite archaeological object or object type, I guess?
This is such a difficult question, possibly because I don't work in archaeology.
Yeah, true. I realized after I had thought of this question that maybe it's a bit biased towards me, so feel free to adjust accordingly.
Well, it kind of, what I figured out is that my answer sort of circles back to what we were talking about before the break, about looking at objects in a way that sees how they were created. And so if there's a really clever object and it was like clever in how it was made, in its function, I like those.
Oh.
So this may come up in a later episode. We don't know yet, but there's, I've seen these like little Korean knives. We're talking like 4 inches, like 10 centimeter knives with a little sheath. And then they have a little pair of chopsticks that it like has like a slot and they just like tuck in. And so it's like a whole little lunch set. Or like
it's
a little...
like a Swiss, a Korean army knife, like Swiss army knife.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But like cool. With a knife and chopsticks. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And then there's like a little like loop at one end so you could like attach it to your... they had belts, but they were different kind of belts. But anyway, so you could like tie to things. So like almost like a little chatelaine sort of idea. And so like that is just so clever. And that somebody, like some metal silversmith was like, yeah, I'll put chopsticks on a knife for you. Sounds great. Love that. Incredible. So like, that's the kind of object that I like, is like some craftsman put in time, thought and effort and was like, yes,
to adapt
this is how
it.
We make this.
Yeah, yeah, custom made. And were they like, was it like a one-off thing that you found an example of, or is it like a common practice?
I've seen it a few times. So, I mean, I don't know the popularity of this and I don't know, I think it would have been like late Joseon, which is like late 1800s, early 1900s. So like fairly recently.
Yeah.
I think. But again, I mean, I don't have access to many Korean objects, so. But yeah, but like that kind of thing. The other thing that I really like is children's toys, antique toys. Because like you can really see the like love and appreciation that like in the useware, using useware for you. Like I worked on a toy tiger, a wooden toy tiger from India. And like a wheel had been replaced because it was like on wheels. And it was clear the tail had been broken off and replaced. And like there was like some damage to it. And so when I worked on it, I was able to bring, like, the repairs had been painted poorly. And so I painted them better to match the original. And so like my whole idea was that it would be familiar to whomever had played with it.
Right. Yeah.
Like that idea of like, you know, these like familiar childhood objects being like universal and
restored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, just that's cute.
Back to the repair shop, right? Like when they have the...
I know, right?
We should just so go on the repair shop.
Like, can we, maybe we could have like an episode or something where maybe we visit and interview them.
But it's...
your favorite?
My favorite? Oh, well, to be fair, I feel like most people know what my favorite kind of archaeological object is, which is the Neolithic Scottish carved stone balls, because they're just really cool. I feel bad though, because now I feel like after your response is really like sweet and like thoughtful and like everything, and now I'm just like, there's these balls that are really cool.
But like no one knows what they were for, right? Well, like they're just mysterious.
Yes, that's the amazing thing. And it's one of those things, like there's so many like pseudo-archaeological, you know, oh, it's this big mystery thing and actually this is the most important thing and we have to work out like why this happened. And it's like, well, no, actually, that's not mysterious. Like, we kind of know about this stuff. But there are other really interesting mysteries that are actual mysteries in archaeology, like these Scottish carved stone balls, which are like, there's like 400 of them made. They all date to the sort of late Neolithic that have been able to be dated. But the main problem is, and this is also what I kind of like about them, because it shows like the evolution of archaeology almost as well, because a lot of them were found in like the mid 1800s. And that was a time where there were like all these, they were mainly found because there were lots of land clearances happening in Scotland, and they were like digging up all of the bog land and like fen land and everything to try and dry it out to make it fit for agriculture and all this kind of stuff. And it was, there's all sorts of political issues that were happening at that time. But because of that, because of all of this like land management and these ditches being dug everywhere, they were finding loads of stuff. But because it was the mid-1800s, they weren't that great at like recording things. So
wait,
we don't.
What?
Yeah, right.
That's crazy.
Oh, it's so fun reading the. I read all of the like original Society of Scottish Antiquarians, and you can access them all for free. Actually, I'll put some in the show notes so that you can see them. All of the original like little reports about how they were found and stuff. And it's like, well, Mr. Smith said that he found it like within view of his barn, or, you know, like a sort of thing. And it's like,
oh. It was 50 paces from the old oak tree on the corner of Mr. Brown's farmland on the northwest side.
Exactly. So yeah, basically. So, I mean, which is also just so fun kind of as well to think like, God, what must they have thought like when they found these things? And they knew that they were from prehistory. Like they weren't, you know, thinking that they were modern or anything. But it's sort of, yeah, it's all of these really interesting. So it's like the objects themselves, the kind of mystery surrounding them, the kind of discovery of the original discoveries of them, and how it's just like, you know, how it shows the way that archaeology has developed. But also the balls themselves are just beautiful. I'll give a link to the National Museum of Scotland have like done a 3D scan of a bunch of them and put them up on Sketchfab so people can have a look at them and see. But yeah, they're just really, they're just so cool. Like they're just,
well, and you know, kind of like in that same line of like, one, they were created and deposited, and then, you know, there's these 1800s presumably dudes writing their little reports with the vague, you know, directions on where they found them, because why would you tell anybody where they were found? And then, you know, like how that information has like, and those balls themselves have like traversed through history and now are like accessible online. So when I was in college, I interned at the Giza Project at Harvard. I was basically digitizing a bunch of the dig records from like the like 1914 to 1916 excavations at Giza. So under Reisner. And so like it was like, oh, Mr. Carter, like Howard Carter, stopped by today and he helped with this thing, or, you know, like it's all these like little day-to-day notes that are included in it. And it's like, oh, the military was target practicing again and they almost hit us. Those are my favorite. I was like, oh, they shot at us again. Oh no. Whoops. I don't think they know we're here. And I'm like, oh, like, and it's such an interesting, like they're discovering all of these things that are like 4,000 years old or something like that. And then at the same time, they are creating their own history. So I feel like these stone balls are like that similar.
Yes.
You know, like you get glimpses of history and then more history, and then it's all mystery, and it's like, very cool.
It's all very cool. So. And it's just kind of the ultimate show of how people really want to know what they were used for. And my favorite artist who makes these, he's called Scott Knight. He's amazing. He's called the Broken Biscuit Repair Workshop. It's his business that he runs, and he does beautiful carvings. Again, I'll put his link in the show notes. And I've chatted to him a lot about these because he makes replicas of them. He carves them out of stone, and he does it with like modern tools, but also he does using traditional tools. And it's very cool to see how he does it. But he's always very much like, oh my God, you don't, like, there doesn't have to be a meaning behind them. Like, there doesn't have to be a reason why they were made. We will never know. And I think that's the perfect metaphor for archaeology, especially prehistoric archaeology, is like, we can say all we want about these things, but at the end of the day, we will actually never know, like, what exactly what happened, like, until we build a time machine.
Right. And then it's also like, I think a lot of people dismiss the value of just pretty things.
Yes.
And like the ability to just make beautiful stuff. Yeah. And so not everything is just because it has a purpose. It could just be pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, well, some carver was like, this is cool. Look what I can do.
Yeah. Which is one of my favorite theories, actually. I was on a judging panel for a competition where they were coming up. It was just like a fun sort of competition that they did to try and come up with a thing for what they were used for. And some of the like suggestions were just really fun, like basically fidget toys, or like, you know, sort of a fun, my favorite one is that they're like a CV for like a portfolio almost. It's like, this is like the, you know, like you take it with you and you're like, look, this is the kind of carving I can do. Like, and it's sort of, so that's why they're all
look
kind
at
of roughly
the smooth edges.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They have all beautiful like designs and stuff, but then some of them have like multiple knobs and some of them just have a couple of knobs, and like, it's sort of showing your variation, your style. But anyway, I don't
or
know.
Like you're like, you know, three-dimensional thinking and yeah, like placing exactly. knobs on a round object. Yeah.
Yeah. Which cool. is really, so I've actually been crocheting them recently because, you know, I'm
I just saw your post
enough.
About that.
Yeah.
So cute.
And they're really fun to do, but it's also really difficult because of course the carved stone versions are being carved out of, like, they're made into a ball and then carved from that ball. Whereas for crochet, mm-hmm. you have to build it up from a ball to like a ball with knob, and so it took me a long time to get the dimensions correct, like for how to attach yeah. the knobs like to the balls.
Well, yeah, it's going in a different direction.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah. But no. Oh, but yeah. But I also really like what you were talking about with like, you can see the sort of repairs that have been made and things. Something that I really love mm-hmm. was during my master's at Leiden, when I was looking at beads, amber beads, and they're drilled from both sides because the drill bits would have been conical shaped. So you couldn't drill all the way through from one side, you had to do like from both sides. And you can see that in the archaeological beads as well. But I was doing experiments where I was replicating the beads, and quite often you just misalign, right? The two sides, because you're drilling from one side, and then you have to flip it over and drill from the other side. And inevitably you'd always slightly misalign, but like I got better at it. And I always remember thinking like, oh my God, this is so rubbish. Like I suck at this. But then I was looking at these Neolithic beads. So like 5,000 to 7,000 years old. And they were also completely misaligned. Like they had to, there was one case where they had to like drill two holes because they'd clearly just completely misaligned the first one. And I just love that. Like it's such those sorts of objects as well, where you can see like the humanity of people. They're really fun.
Yeah, exactly. Like we have this, I feel like there's a, I don't know, you see history through this like rose colored glasses of like, oh, look how quaint, look how nice, look how, you know, but there's like the human error in it. And there's like the... I mean, there is incredible artistry and skill that, like, I think, honestly, we've lost a lot in our modern era. But there's, like, there are those little mistakes that go, oh, cute. Or, like, I love it when there's, like, fingerprints in something. Yes. Like, didn't they just discover one that was, like, yes, when the cat walks through the, like, tiles or something?
The Roman tiles, yeah.
So cute.
Yeah, they were just discovered?
Well, it was, like, a post on social media, so we don't know how accurate it was,
result,
but yeah, I feel like they found like quote unquote the oldest fingerprint, or how old that now is, but I mean some receptive surface held a fingerprint was surprisingly old.
We will look that up, and if it is indeed a valid thing, then we will put the link in the show notes.
We could do a whole episode about fingerprints in archaeology, and that would be pretty cool. Okay, we'll add that to the list.
That's a very good, I'm adding that to the list now. Fingerprints. Fingerprints / paw prints.
Oh, and then we can take it back to my forensics days. This will be great.
Yes. Oh, that sounds
good. It all ties together.
Oh, see. Ah,
perfect.
All coming together. Well,
no degree is wasted. You heard it here. They're all useful. It doesn't matter if you use
On which note, I think it's about time to wrap up. We are probably running out of time on this particular tea break. But yeah, this was a fun first discussion, and I'm really looking forward to future episodes to come.
Yeah. And if you guys have any ideas about future topics that we should talk about, if you have any questions for either of us, reach out, say hi.
Yes.
We like it.
Please do. It's been so nice having Jess on because indeed, as you said at the beginning of the episode, like sometimes you feel like you're just speaking into the void as a sort of single podcaster. And it has been so nice to have someone to actually chat to. So it's always so, but it is also really good to hear from people who are listening in. But I said that in the last few episodes as well. So please do get in touch. We always like hearing from people who are listening in.
Yeah, a bunch of my knitters tuned in for the knitting episodes.
Oh, nice.
Mostly because I told them about it, but they were like, that was really fun. I really liked that.
Cool. There's more to come. Yeah, so probably we could do a bit of a sneak peek. So the next couple of episodes, we're going to be looking at cutlery.
Yes.
Sorry, I feel like I have to just, even though I know this isn't at my trial, I'm going to make a Terry Pratchett reference because...
always. It can be just part of the network.
Right? If people don't know what I'm talking about, Go listen to Am I Trial. After you listen to at least one episode, you'll know why this is a thing. As every episode, I reference Terry Pratchett somehow. But there's this one episode with one character, and it's talking about how he speaks so posh that you can't actually understand him. And so he's talking about the gallery, the art gallery, and he goes, "Galleria." And the audiobook narrator is really good at like doing "Galleria" and "Raw" and like makes it really good. And so I was listening to it at some point out loud, like not just on my headphones. So my husband was listening as well, and he found that bit quite funny. So now whenever we talk about cutlery, it's not cutlery, it's cutlery. So I had to try really hard just then when I said the next episodes not to just go cutlerel. So yes, I hope you appreciated my
I love it. Also, what is very important, read Terry Pratchett, is that in grad school when we met, I had not read Terry Pratchett, and I apologize that it took me so long. But when I interned with my former boss, Mimi Levesque, I love her, she was like, "Oh, listen to them out of order. So start with Going Postal." And so
yes.
I started with Going Postal.
Oh, that's a good one to start with.
And yeah, it was sort of like a good dip your toe into the world without
it is very good.
Getting deeper. And then like go back. And then I think I did Going Postal, and then I did Mort.
That's also a good one.
And then,
yes.
Yeah. And so now I have a much greater
appreciation
and understanding of Terry Pratchett and the Discworld as a whole. Yeah. I have not read to all of them, but eventually.
We'll make it. We'll make it there.
There's so many of them.
There are so many.
So I tried.
And bringing it back to this podcast again, having more experience with something has given you a better appreciation for the skill of the craft, in this case, right?
Exactly. Yes. Tie it all together.
There we go. We did it. We brought it back. Well, I hope that everyone listening enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN, like And My Trowel, for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about all of the things that we talked about in today's episode, you can find all of the links and the contact information in the show notes. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.